This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hey there, welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Allergic disorders are the most common medical problem faced by children today. In fact, 20% of kids suffer from some kind of allergy. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking about the causes, the symptoms, the tests, and treatments for a wide variety of allergies. We're going to be covering nasal allergies, food allergies, asthma, eczema, milk allergies, gluten sensitivity, and a lot of others. We're going to be speaking with a pediatrician and an expert in allergies about the scientific background that you're going to need to understand what allergies are and how they impact our families. We're going to get you the knowledge to recognize allergies before they develop, and the practical steps that you can take to reduce or eliminate allergens in your home. We'll even talk about what to expect at visits to the pediatrician's office if you've got a child with an allergy, and even a number of alternative treatment options that can help make your life as a parent as easy and happy and allergy-free as possible. Of course, we're also going to be clearing up some of the common misconceptions and myths about allergies and even go into some things about the pros and cons of going gluten or lactose-free, which is something that's all over the news these days, along with things like GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and pesticides and food colorings. It all starts when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
I put out way too much trash to think about recycling. I just don't get it.
Some things are very obvious, Maria.
Learn the difference between trash and recycling and more on our website, YouGottaBeKidding.org. Visit YouGottaBeKidding.org today.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Robert Sears, who's the co-author with Dr. William Sears of the allergy book, Solving Your Family's Nasal Allergies, Asthma, Food Sensitivities, and Related Health and Behavior Problems. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Sure. I'm very happy to be on the show.
Let's talk a little bit about, I think, first of all, what an allergy is. And I know that it has to do with proteins and it's a complicated thing, but I think it's important just to basically set the stage for us about what it is and how it differs from an intolerance.
Yeah, essentially, an allergy is the body's immune response to something that invades your body that you are essentially, I guess, allergic to. We call those things allergens, and they're proteins, and you either inhale them or swallow them, and then your immune system launches basically a response through the histamine chemicals in your body, and then all the different white blood cells and different parts of your immune system react and give off even more chemicals, and kind of the result can vary from just minor runny nose and sneezing all the way up to severe shock, severe anaphylaxis, life-threatening emergency situations. On the other side of this is kind of the long-term wear and tear on the body. If you have ongoing allergies in your body, it really leads to a lot of inflammation and chronic low-level damage to different body systems. So that's kind of why it's important to track down your allergies and deal with them and then try to identify what they are so you can eliminate them and have a healthier life.
Do you think for something like hay fever, which is one of the low-level allergies I think probably a lot of people will have or have familiarity with, that I think, I hear from people every once in a while, I don't want to take any drugs, I don't want to have the medication. Is the damage that you're talking about, the long-term damage that's being done to the body, less than what would be done by taking a medication for it? Or is that like a personal choice, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I certainly have taken allergy meds from time to time throughout my life. And I do feel like they are very reasonably safe. I've taken them even every day for months when I've needed to. But I feel like people just don't want to rely on medications chronically. You kind of feel like you're not investigating your health enough, if you have to rely on, I guess, such a simple solution is a pill. I feel like even the hay fever is kind of a minor annoyance sometimes. You know, for children, we tend to take it seriously because children with nasal allergies do have a higher risk of going on to develop asthma and chronic asthma throughout their whole life. And so, especially with children, any child I see in my office with sneezing, runny nose, chronic nasal allergies, I know asthma is down the road for them very possibly. So I like to solve it when it's a minor annoyance before it becomes a lifelong problem.
Well, what is the connection between allergy and asthma? Because it sounds like you're saying that one can develop into the other one, but that doesn't sound like what an allergy would do by itself.
Right. Well, allergies kind of take a step-by-step process through the body. You know, infants often will have skin allergies, or we call it eczema, due to food allergies, chemical sensitivities against their skin. And basically that starts off the inflammation within an infant or a young child's body. And it basically revs up the immune system, so you might start reacting to other things in life. And so then you become a child with nasal allergies, but then the allergic response starts to involve the lungs, and then your lungs start to get more and more chronically inflamed, and then you develop asthma. It's kind of a domino effect throughout your body. And so allergies don't always stick with one system. They can go throughout your body and give you more and more problems the older you get. So that's why it's pretty important to try to nip them in the bud as early in your life as you can.
And William Sears is your dad, right?
Yes, he is, yeah.
Okay. How does... I'm just kind of want to go back to asthma just a little bit again, because that's something that I had as a kid, and I think it turned out to be mostly exercise-induced. But how does that manifest itself in an allergy sort of way? Because I think that, I mean, for me, for example, I'll just give you my thing. I mean, if I have a glass of really cold water sometimes, that can trigger something. But I would probably not want to say that I'm allergic to cold water.
Right.
Or cold air.
Right.
Right. So, but it's still triggering that kind of inflammation in the lungs that looks like an allergy.
Right, right. I too have asthma. I've had it throughout most of my life, and I feel like I've gotten on top of it now and gotten it to virtually resolve. Basically, someone with asthma, they don't just have simple allergic responses in their lungs. Their lungs basically have much higher levels of immune cells and allergy cells just floating around in the lung tissues, just ready to respond to anything. Whether it's cold water in your case, some people it's a little reflux of stomach acid. Some people it's pollens in the air or pets. Some people it's even exercise that induces an inflammatory response in the lungs. All the immune cells in your lungs just instantly release all their chemicals that cause the wheezing and the inflammation. And day after day after day, that really can cause a lot of wear and tear on the lung tissues. And you can really develop, chronic daily asthma if you don't get on top of your body's health, try to lower your overall inflammation, get your body back into shape so you can actually physically lower, that sort of allergic inflammation within your lungs and, through your whole body.
Right. Now, you guys talk in the book about some of the myths and misconceptions about allergies. What are those?
That's a good question. I guess we like to try to educate people a lot about why allergies are more common nowadays. Why do we see so many more allergic disorders now than what we think was reported many, many years ago, even decades ago? And a lot of it really has to do with environmental chemicals, toxins, pollutants, what we put in the foods, artificial ingredients in foods. There's a lot of talk about GMO foods, genetically modified organisms. That plays a role in allergies. Environmental changes play a role in allergies. Global warming. the higher carbon dioxide content in our atmosphere is, created more plant growth, which gives off more pollens and creates even more allergies. So there's a lot of things are going in the wrong direction for our kind of our modernized society with all these pollutants and chemicals. And I feel like one way parents can kind of get back on track and get a hold of their health is to kind of go back to nature, so to speak, try to live a more natural, organic life, more chemical-free life around your house, and kind of go green. The greener you can go in your house and with your diet,
yeah,
I think that the better your allergies will be.
I'm kind of curious what you think about the new information that seems to have come out about peanut allergies. Because there used to be, until very recently, you don't give babies peanuts of any peanut having containing foods for at least the first year because of the concern about peanut allergies. And also honey, I think, is very similar. And then I've just heard within the past couple of months that they're thinking that perhaps a little bit of peanut introduction early on can actually prevent developing into an allergy. That just seems to be a complete reversal of, I don't know, decades worth of pediatric advice.
Yeah, you're actually right. 18 years ago when I first became a pediatrician, I used to always tell everyone, don't give your children peanuts or peanut butter until they're two. And you're right, newer research is showing that cultures around the world that feed their children peanuts early on have a far fewer rates of peanut allergy among their children. So we actually think nowadays you should introduce what are the typically allergenic foods probably during the first year of life of an infant's life. You certainly don't want to start with peanuts, but nowadays we think the proper advice with kids is to introduce almost all foods, even by 9 or 10 months of age, so that the infant's immature immune system kind of gets more used to it,
mm-hmm,
and learns to tolerate it while the immune system is young. For infants, especially infants who are breastfeeding, we find that if you introduce certain allergic foods while an infant is still breastfeeding, the infant's immune system learns to tolerate those foods better and is less likely to become allergic to them as they get older.
Robert Sears is the co-author with William Sears of the allergy book, Solving Your Family's Nasal Allergies, Asthma, Food Sensitivities, and Related Health and Behavioral Problems. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Robert.
You must be your fairy godmother. Yes.
It doesn't take a fairy godmother to tell you that the right fit means everything.
Good heavens, child. You can't go in that.
Children under 4'9" need to be in a booster seat because they aren't ready for adult safety belts alone. Remember that 4'9" is the magic number. And get your little pumpkin there safely in a booster seat.
Oh, thank you.
For more information, visit boosterseat.gov. This has been a message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Robert Sears, who's the co-author with his father, William Sears, of the allergy book, and want to get in a little bit to how parents can, I guess even before they know that their children could potentially have an allergy, so we're dealing with a very little kid here, how you can set things up so that you can prevent allergies before they happen, or you can at least kind of figure out a little bit about what they might be allergic to. But when they're very, very young.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I think that's the whole key is, can we prevent these disorders from happening in the first place? And, we can. There are so many things you can do with your young children that will set them up to hopefully live an allergy-free life. And it really centers around the gut, keeping the intestinal system healthy, because that's actually the largest allergic system in our body is the gut. That's actually the largest part of our immune system. So things like limiting antibiotics while you're young, keeping the gut healthy by not overdoing antibiotics, not overdoing sugar. Essentially, what keeps our gut healthy is having the right kind of bacteria living in our gut. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about probiotics and our gut flora and what kind of healthy bacteria or unhealthy bacteria we have in the gut. And a lot of that really depends on how we eat, the antibiotics we overdo, just how healthy we live. And so if you can keep your child antibiotic-free as best you can, eat, organic foods, healthy foods, don't overdo the sugar, that really goes, actually, surprisingly, goes a very long way in keeping your gut healthy and helping you develop or helping you prevent allergic problems as you get older. And when you have allergic problems, when they've already set in, focusing on healing the gut is extremely important. We think for a lot of people it might be, really focusing on a lot of fruits and vegetables and eating a lot of fresh fish, fresh salmon, eating a lot of probiotic-rich foods, foods that have a lot of the healthy bacteria that we need to replenish our intestinal system. Even taking probiotic supplements sometimes can help reduce allergic disorders. So if you really are stuck with an allergic problem like asthma or chronic nasal allergies or skin allergies, you really want to focus on your intestinal health, healing the gut with healthy diets and probiotics, and you might find your allergic problems improve as your gut health improves.
Now, about probiotics, how do you know how much to take or which one to take? Because it seems like you go to the health food store, you even go to Costco, for goodness sake, and there are so many different kinds, and they all seem to have, somebody's got 10 billion, this one's got 20 billion, and they all have different names. But it seems like each of us has an individual system. So how do I know what I should be taking as opposed to what my kids should be taking?
Well, you do want to definitely dose in terms of hundreds of billions is really what you want. Most people underdose probiotics. So I usually encourage people to certainly follow the recommended dose on a product if you buy it, but ask your doctor or your nutritionist if you can take, two or three times the dose that's listed on the label, because you really do need to dose in terms of some people will take 10 billion, 20 billion, even, literally some people will recommend 100 or 200 billion, organisms as a daily dose of a probiotic under the guidance of a doctor. But what's even more important, instead of just buying a product, if you can eat foods that are rich in probiotics, rich mm-hmm. in all those healthy bacteria, foods like kefir made from milk or coconut kefir, you can make homemade sour cream, sauerkraut, and other fermented cultured vegetable dishes that are very rich in probiotics. Kombucha is a very, very popular fermented tea that has a lot of healthy probiotics in it. So sometimes it's about what you eat, not just about the product you buy.
Right.
That can help replenish your gut with all those healthy bacteria and lower your allergic problems.
So, okay, here's an analogy. From my understanding, people who take testosterone supplements can interfere with their own body's natural ability to produce testosterone. Similarly, I'm wondering, if you take a bunch of probiotics, are you interfering with your body's ability to produce the healthy bacteria that it needs to be producing?
Well, that's a great question, but I think that the analogy doesn't totally hold true, because we don't actually produce our own probiotics, or our body's not making them like we would say make testosterone. The probiotics are the germs just multiply on their own within our gut. They multiply like all bacteria do. So the whole key is to create a healthy environment within your gut, so all those healthy germs can thrive. And so by eating diets high in fiber, low in sugar, low in unhealthy carbs. Because unhealthy carbs feed the bad bacteria. We don't want the bad bacteria to overgrow. When you eat a lot of sugar or a lot of carbs, that's just nutrients for all the bad bacteria to overgrow and contribute to the allergic problems. Instead, by essentially starving your bad bacteria, by limiting your carbs, and then feeding all your good bacteria by eating, you know, probiotic-rich foods and healthy foods, healthy fruits and vegetables and proteins, that all just helps create a healthier environment in the gut. So all the good germs thrive, the bad germs die off, and then it's really those healthy germs that help regulate, keep our immune system in balance, and can help keep the allergic problems under control.
It seems like, I don't mean to use this word in a terribly negative way, but that certain allergies have become almost trendy, and gluten being one of them. And
yeah.
I mean, you know, there's whole sections in stores now, gluten-free, and so many products are labeled as gluten-free. I understand from talking to a functional medicine doctor friend of mine who said that so many people are not gluten-free, but, I mean, who don't need to be, are going gluten-free, and it can actually hurt them. Is that correct?
Yeah, what I've found is we know for sure that about 1% of our population has a celiac disease, or essentially have an extremely severe allergy to gluten. And then we know that, you know, that's been verified by many research studies. So 1%, it's not a small number. You know, if you think 1% of the people walking around our city, you know, 1 in 100 people really do need to be gluten-free because they have a very severe allergy called celiac disease. And then there are, I feel like gluten sensitivity, where it's not severe, life-threatening, but it still is a sensitivity. You know, more and more doctors are beginning to believe that it is real and it is true. You know, it is certainly not a majority of our population, but as a pediatrician, I've found enough patients whose health improves dramatically when they go gluten-free, that and you know, there's some good medical testing you can do that can look for gluten sensitivity. I do believe it is real. Actually, I don't think it's a fad. I feel like you know, some doctors believe it's because we've modified wheat so heavily over these last few decades. Food scientists have essentially crossbred and modified and hybridized wheat to such an extent that it's a totally unnatural grain nowadays. It's completely different than the wheat that our ancestors ate, you know, 100 and 1,000 years ago. And so people's immune systems are actually having an unusual reaction to this modern-day wheat. A lot of these people can probably go back and you can actually search out what are considered ancient strains of wheat, more pure natural strains of wheat that are grown in different parts of the world, and you probably find you won't react to that older form of wheat because it's more natural and it's more designed for what our bodies are able to handle. So I can't tell you how many patients I've seen with complex allergic problems who have improved actually by going gluten-free. You know, I definitely would stress that you want to make sure you are improving from it, that you are responding well, because you only want to do it if you need to, right? You don't want to just do it because it's trendy. You want to do it because you're going to benefit from it. And if you do, you stick with it. And if you don't, then you don't have to stick with it.
Robert W. Sears, the co-author with William Sears of the allergy book, Solving Your Family's Nasal Allergies, Asthma, Food Sensitivities, and Related Health and Behavioral Problems. Bob, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
At 4:15 p.m. at an office in Michigan, Angie Hicks is not at her desk. She's giving blood at the company blood drive.
At the same time in the same office, Kevin Meehan is not at his desk. He's at the doctor. Kevin has cancer and needs another round of chemo.
Kevin will need blood to fight his cancer.
Angie's blood will help him win.
When you give blood to the American Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to schedule your appointment to give blood.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Babies are wonderful, and we love them, and we care for them. We're amazed by them, but sometimes they really can bring out the worst in us. And that's the topic of today's Ask Mr. Dad segment. Dear Mr. Dad, I'm a new dad, and I sometimes get incredibly angry when my son cries. Of course, I haven't acted on my anger, but I'm feeling really guilty that I get so mad in the first place. I've always been a pretty patient guy, but I don't think I've ever had such intense feelings before. Am I a bad parent? You know, babies have an amazing capacity to bring out feelings in us that are powerful, unfamiliar, and sometimes scary. On the positive side, we get to experience being on the receiving end and the giving end of unconditional love, and that's something I really and truly believe does not exist between adults. On the negative side, though, there are the feelings you described. We all like to believe that we'd throw ourselves in front of a moving train to save our children, but every once in a while, they make us so furious that we think, really briefly though, of throwing them in front of the train. I know that sounds horrible, but here's a reality check. Everyone has feelings like that. Anyone who tells you otherwise is either lying to you or doesn't have children. So, no, you're not a bad parent at all. That said, while there's nothing wrong with feeling intense anger, it's what you do with it that can be a problem. Here are some suggestions that I'm pretty sure will help you get your anger under control. First, figure out the source. Sometimes it's the child's actual behavior. Other times it could be a health problem, pressure at work, relationship troubles, or even just a really rotten day. Think like a child. For the most part, babies aren't able to control their behavior. Crying is normal, and babies will do it for as much as a few hours a day. If it goes on longer than that, have a talk with your pediatrician. Your son's cries may seem like a deliberate plot to annoy you, but they really aren't. Sometimes babies cry for no particular reason, but other times it's because they're hungry, tired, overstimulated, or uncomfortable. If you pay close attention, you'll learn to decipher your baby's language. You won't get it right every time, but the feeling you get getting your baby to stop crying by responding appropriately to his needs is really incredible. Get out. When you start feeling that blinding fury around your baby, the best thing you can do for him and for yourself is to put him someplace safe, a crib is best, and get out of the room for a few minutes. Babies can feel tension in the air, and staying near your son when you're angry will make him cry even more and could push you closer to doing something you'd regret for the rest of your life. I refer to this sometimes as the flight attendant school of parenting. You know, the whole thing about the oxygen mask dropping and you're supposed to put yours on before you put your children's on, before you help the people with you. I never quite got that, I don't think, until I had kids. And you realize, if you can't breathe, you can't help anybody else. So you've got to get yourself under control before you can be an effective parent. Learn to laugh. As your child gets older, you'll need to keep your sense of humor. Putting a slice of Velveeta cheese into the DVD player or flushing your car keys down the toilet can cause some damage, but they can also be pretty funny. Watch what you say and what you do. This one is for slightly older kids, but it's good to start thinking about it now. Avoid mixed messages. Screaming at your son to stop screaming won't help, and stick to I messages. It's more effective to say, "I don't like it when you write on the walls with lipstick," than "you're a bad boy because you wrote on the wall." And keep in mind that your child will learn more about how he should act when he's angry from watching you than from timeouts and long-winded explanations. Get some help now. If there's another trusted adult around, great. Ask him or her to spell you for a while. If not, it's critical that you put some distance between you and the baby. Put him down someplace safe and call a friend, a relative, your pediatrician, or the National Crying Baby Hotline at 866-243-2229 or the National Child Help Hotline at 800-422-4453. Asking for help is not a sign of weakness, and it certainly doesn't mean you're a bad parent. In fact, in my view, it's really a sign of strength. We'll be back next week with another Ask Mr. Dad segment or a Parents at Play segment. But wait a minute, don't go quite yet, because there's a lot more positive parenting coming up right after this.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
I feel like I'm choking.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
You know how to react to their asthma attacks. Here's how to prevent them. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. Visit www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Did you know 26 million Americans have kidney disease and most don't know it? Did you know understanding your risk of kidney disease may be the first step in treating it? Visit the National Kidney Foundation at kidney.org. Now you know.
Hey there, welcome to today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brandt. In 1983, Dr. Janet Woititz published a groundbreaking book called Adult Children of Alcoholics, and it became the premier work on the subject, and it was on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 40 weeks, which is an incredible amount of time. Her inspiration for writing, it stemmed from being married to an alcoholic and seeing the suffering that her children were going through, along with her own desire to help others going through the same experience. Now, there's a new book out that further explores the reasons why adult children of alcoholics or addicts continue the destructive cycle and how to stop it. No one is better equipped to carry the message than Dr. Woititz's daughter, Lisa, who is an adult child of alcoholics and a former program director of the Institute for Counseling and Training. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with Lisa Sue Woititz about a book that she co-wrote with her mother, and we're going to be talking about things like what adult children of alcoholics and addicts can do to help break the cycle. Approaches that adult children of alcoholics can take when their own children are using alcohol or other drugs. How self-examination, letting go of expectations, and trusting your instincts all contribute to positive change. And why reconnecting with an addicted parent could either be a step forward in the healing process or unhealthy and dangerous. I'm Armin Brandt. Our discussion about breaking a family's cycle of addictive behavior starts right after this. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brandt, and my guest for this part of today's show is Lisa Sue Woititz, who is the co-author with Dr. Janet Woititz of Unwelcome Inheritance, Break Your Family's Cycle of Addictive Behaviors. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Excited to be here talking to you.
So I was going through the book, and towards the very beginning of it, it mentions, you know, obviously, the authors of it. And I noticed that your mother passed away in 1994. I'm kind of curious how it is that you happened to co-write this. I know that one of her books was about being the adult child of an alcoholic, and you somehow kind of fell into the same line of work and then did this together. Was there actually a collaboration?
Well, my mom was the founder of the movement for adult children of alcoholics. She was the first person who really was able to explain to this particular group of people what happened to them when they were growing up and sort of put a name to this problem. As some people know and some people don't know, she passed away very young with a lot of work left to do. And so Unwelcome Inheritance is really the continuation of Adult Children of Alcoholics. My mom's work helped to clarify for people and to help them find peace with what they had experienced. Unwelcome Inheritance is going the next step after that, where, you know, we've taken the time to look at ourselves, but now we're looking at the recovery of the family. And
okay.
So what I've done in Unwelcome Inheritance is to tell my story, because I grew up with alcoholism, to tell my story and sort of weave that around unpublished work of my mother's and my professional experience. So that's
okay.
Why, in that sense, yes, it is a collaboration.
Okay. Can you just for a minute take us back a little bit and give us kind of an overview of what the experience is of an adult child of an alcoholic and kind of summarize your mom's work a little bit?
Sure. Well, my mom wrote about the characteristics of adult children of alcoholics, and that list actually came from her first group of ACOAs, as we call them, who met in the living room of the house I grew up in. I used to eavesdrop when I was supposed to be sleeping. And this group together came up with this list of characteristics that described the experience of what they went through. And I can tell you what that list is if you would like.
Sure, a little bit of it anyway, yeah.
Okay, well, in short, it has a lot to do with how we don't really know what normal families look like and how to behave. A lot of self-judgment, a lack of self-confidence, and a sort of a comfort level with chaos, being super responsible, super irresponsible, impulsivity. So there are certain things that affect us as adults. And really it comes from the fact that even though we may have grown up with a lot of adult responsibilities because we were in a situation that was really very intense for a young child, we weren't really raised with a childhood. So you have adults, you have children that have taken on adult responsibilities too soon, who grow up to be adults that have a hard time raising children and lack some basic skills and understanding of how to live a daily life without crisis.
Right. Now, can we just for the sake of discussion kind of include any kind of addiction in there?
Absolutely.
I mean,
in fact, not only can we include any kind of addiction, but we've also found that so many people relate to this work, whether military children can relate, people that grew up in ultra-religious families, all sorts of backgrounds. So Unwelcome Inheritance is very inclusive, or tries to be.
Right.
Tries to bring everybody in.
So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that over the course of the show will probably, you'll recognize that I have no idea anything about alcoholism, really. But, I mean,
okay.
I mean, on a personal level is what I mean. I know from having known some alcoholics that people, even after they stop, they still consider themselves to be alcoholics. And you mentioned in the book that your dad has 40 years at least of being in recovery. If you are the child of somebody who has been in recovery for most of your childhood or all of it, does that still include you in the group of adult children of alcoholics? Are there still some of the fallout from the kinds of things that you're talking about? Because I can imagine when you're describing the not having a childhood and growing up, and that if you are dealing with somebody who is actively drunk or addicted and is not taking care of their parental responsibilities, that's one thing. But if somebody is technically still an alcoholic but in recovery, does that make a difference?
Well, yes and no. There's a large part of addiction that has to do with body chemistry, and that's something that is passed down through generations. So even if you didn't grow up, let's say your parents were in recovery, or they never were alcoholic, maybe it skipped a generation or whatever, that doesn't mean that you don't have that chemistry. So that's a part of it. And also, the other part of it, and it does get kind of confusing, it's kind of difficult to tease it apart sometimes, but since this is something that runs through generations of families, even if my mother or father didn't drink at all, maybe they were raised by alcoholic parents. So they've got the chemistry, even though it wasn't ignited, and they grew up with those dynamics. So it all gets kind of passed down the line, and if we're not educated about it, we just perpetuate that cycle.
Okay. No, that makes sense. I mean, I was just trying to figure out, you know, the definition of, if there's a definition of, you call somebody an active alcoholic or in recovery, what's the right terminology for that?
Right. Well, an active alcoholic is somebody who's actively using alcohol, and an alcoholic in recovery is somebody who is probably attending 12-step meetings, probably in some kind of treatment, but is abstaining from alcohol. And we say that it's a disease because it can be arrested, but it can't be cured.
Right.
So, for example, if I'm an alcoholic and I haven't had a drink in 20 years, if I put alcohol into my system, I run a very huge risk of tripping the disease all over again. And many people will say, there's a popular saying that while we're taking our medicine, say in a support group, our disease is outside doing push-ups. So people believe that the disease continues to progress even when we abstain. So if you put that into your system, even after a long period of time, chances are that you might have a far worse result than you would imagine.
Lisa, is there a way, I mean, with so many other diseases, heart disease, with diabetes, or many other kinds of conditions, there's a test for it, or you can run a blood test and you can say, oh, you have this particular condition. Does that show up somehow in the blood or the brain chemistry or something of people so you can say clinically you are an alcoholic or you have the carrier, you're a carrier of the gene?
You know what, that's such a great question. I know that there have been studies done that have looked at brain activity. And I'm not an expert in science by any stretch of the imagination, but there are studies that show that even talking about a substance that a person is addicted to shows activity in the brain. So that science is there. The other part of that is, and this is something I've experienced for myself, is that part of what alcoholism is on the biochemistry side of it is an inability for the body to metabolize sugar properly. So, and since addiction runs in families and it may look differently for different people, you may have an alcoholic and a sugar addict in the same family. It manifests itself differently. So you might see different things in different families.
Well, you'd think that that would...
I have a body chemistry of an alcoholic, absolutely for sure. And I can't tolerate any sugar whatsoever. For me, that's sort of two sides of the same coin. So I abstain from all of it. And that's really hard to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Lisa Sue Wojtyc is the co-author with Dr. Janet Wojtyc of Unwelcome Inheritance, Break Your Family's Cycle of Addictive Behavior. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Lisa.
My name's Rachel, and in 8 years, I'll be an alcoholic.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
I'll start drinking in middle school, and I'll do some things I don't really want to do. So by the time my parents talk to me about it, alcohol won't be my only problem.
So start talking before they start drinking. To learn more, go to StopAlcoholAbuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Lisa Wojtyc, who is the co-author of Unwelcome Inheritance, Break Your Family's Cycle of Addictive Behaviors. I know with some kinds of behavior or some kinds of personal histories, whether it's violence or abuse or things like that, that kids often feel that they're kind of doomed to repeat the sins of their parents. But on the other hand, a lot of people are able to consciously make a decision, I will not do what my parents did. And so you're not obviously doomed to do that. Do you feel that there is an ability to consciously make those kinds of a decision? Sounds like you have made that kind of a decision.
Well, you know, you do describe extremes that are seen a lot. You know, I'm never going to be anything like that person is one extreme. And then, of course, the other extreme is following right in the footsteps of. And I know in my case, education was power. I started learning about the disease of alcoholism and addiction from the age of 8 years old when my father went into treatment. And what it did for me was what I would call raising the bottom. Because I knew and understood what had happened in my family and why, and I understood that I was at risk, and now I believe that I've got the chemistry, it really does go a long way toward tempering behavior. But then again, sometimes there are life circumstances and things take a turn we don't expect, and we find ourselves in a place where we never expected to be. So All of that is true. And as parents, we do our best. And after a certain age or, you know, wherever our kids are up to, there's only so much that we can do. But I think the education is really key.
Talk a little bit about the breaking the cycle of anger and resentment, because there's going to be anger. I suppose you're lashing out at the parents who gave you this genetic bomb. What other kinds of anger are there?
Well, when my mother passed away, she and I were having a lot of conversations about what we called the stuck place. And the stuck place is where we understand what happened to us, and we understand that it's your fault. And what I'm trying to teach in Unwelcome Inheritance is that that's not enough. That if we really want to take our healing to the next level, then in order to be able to let go of that anger and move past it, and ultimately, if it's safe, to move toward that person who's probably a parent who has hurt us the most, we need to widen our view. And I liken that to looking through a camera. You know, when you're looking through a camera and you're looking at something really close up and that's all you see in your lens, if we step back, we see a little bit more. And if we step back a few more times, we see a lot more. And what I'm hoping that people will be compelled to do after they read the book is to look at their family that way, and to look at those people, in my case it was my father, who I blamed for every problem of mine and every problem in the world, and to see that they have a story too, and they have a history too, and to stand in their shoes and try to look at the world from their point of view, and to understand them with the same compassion that we want to be understood. And I feel that it's doubly important because, you know, as many people my age, I have children and I have, thankfully, I still have my father. And if I can't let go of my anger toward my father and leave the door open for the possibility of healing our relationship, and, you know, he's not the same man he used to be. He's transformed, and it would be a shame to not allow that new wonderful person into my life, but my children lose out also because they're not going to have a relationship with their grandfather, and that's something that will get passed down to the generations to come. So the short answer is I think that the first place to start letting go of that anger is to get healthy ourselves and be honest about everything that we're feeling. And then try to see the other people in our family in terms of their own story.
Yeah.
And many times we'll realize, you know, if I were that person, maybe I would have had a few drinks myself.
It's interesting because I'm thinking that that's such a mature kind of an attitude to have, to do exactly what you're saying, to not want to miss out on the person your father is now as opposed to the person that he was then. It seems like it's so easy to just write off that person and just say, you know, you weren't there, you were abusive, you were a bad parent, you were spending all of your time at liquor stores or whatever it was, and to forget about that there is another story.
And you know what, I'm so glad that you said that, because if I told you what I had lived through as a child, and I told you I was never going to speak to my father again because of it, I don't think you would blame me. You might even encourage me. I don't think that you would even question that. But what I'm proposing is not to do that, because life is short.
Right.
And if we are really, wanting to live our lives at that higher level and really be the catalyst for healing in our families, we have the ability to do that. And so yes, I'm really glad you said that, because that's pretty much the whole point.
Well, really, going a little bit further than that, though, Do you worry that you're kind of absolving your father of having to take responsibility for what he did? Or do we just skip that altogether and move from what he was to what he is?
Well,
and I don't mean to pick on your father. I don't mean to pick on your father necessarily, just kind of using him as a metaphor.
That's okay. He can take it.
Okay.
It's not that we're denying reality. We're not denying anything that happened. But we recognize that, you know, we were a sick family and that he has a disease. And that, trust me, he's really not happy about what he remembers. And there's plenty that he doesn't remember. So all of that is true. We acknowledge the past, but we're willing to heal. And sometimes it takes a long time to change. In my case, my father, even after he got sober, we really didn't see changes for many years. And I think because his brain was pickled, that was the case. So change takes a really long time. But back to that higher level, if we can just leave the door open for the possibility of change and embrace the changes that we make in other people, then that's to me the ideal.
Yeah.
And so we're not pretending that it didn't happen. We're just willing to move past it.
Right.
Because we can. In some cases we can't. You know, I mean there are some situations where I would never recommend that somebody move toward a perpetrator of some terrible crime. That's a whole different animal.
Right, right.
But I really do believe that there are cases where we should do this. And I go to a lot of 12-step meetings, and I hear every day, I hear stories. Usually they are men. I'm not making a statement of fact, but it's just an observation. Usually they are men who have been in recovery for a long time, and their kids will not speak to them, no matter how well they're doing, no matter how they would go to the ends of the earth to show and to be and to make amends, and their kids don't want to have anything to do with them. And I can't help but think that those kids can't really feel whole. But like you said before, it really is easier to walk away in anger sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, just the way you're describing that, I'm finding myself feeling very sad about the whole. I mean, it seems tragic, really, that would happen. But it's so hard to do what you're doing.
We're kind of sealing the fate for generations to come.
Right, right, because you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater, to use a completely superficial.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to report that even though as a child I obsessed on wanting my father to die, wanting him to get hit by a bus, something. I wanted him gone. And we have such a great relationship today. And I'm really thankful for it because I don't have my mother anymore.
Right.
So I feel that I have lived what I'm talking about. And by the same token, although my addiction problems were not nearly as severe as my father or a lot of other people, I did. I hurt my kids just because I wasn't really present. Was pretty inconsistent. I was more crisis oriented. I didn't handle things in a calm way on a day to day basis. I waited for things to get to the point of crisis before they really got my attention and things like this. And I have explained to them that the way that I parented and the way I've lived my life is what I've learned, and that I am doing better and I want to do better and I want to be the best mother that I can, and I've cared about what they've had to say about it, and all of that has transformed. Not that it was ever terrible, but it wasn't great. So
Lisa,
I feel that I've lived what I'm trying to teach.
Lisa Sue Wojtitz is the co-author of Unwelcome Inheritance, Break Your Family's Cycle of Addictive Behavior. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.